We should have a third participant showing up. Farouk Elbaz intends to come over, and he's a little bit late. Dr. Sidney Fox of the University of Miami presented a paper this morning that I think will find some interest on origins of life and amino acids. And Dr. Lawrence Nyquist also presented something on rubidium strontium dating. And they're going to briefly summarize their papers, and then they'll answer questions if you like. Dr. Fox?
Very well. Well, my paper was presented with co-authors P.E. Hare, H-A-R-R-E, who's at the Geophysical Laboratory of the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C., and with Dr. K. Harada, H-A-R-A-D-A, who's at our institute at the University of Miami. We actually gave a review and an overview of the work that we've been doing in the search for an identification of amino acids from lunar samples, starting with Apollo 11. And we've now analyzed. Now, we've gotten very much the same pattern of five or six amino acids with glycine, G-L-Y-C-I-N-E, dominant among these five or six amino acids. And this pattern is very different from two kinds of pattern that one can get from contamination. This is a large part of the evidence which rules out the possibility, essentially rules out the possibility that what we're looking at is contamination from the astronauts, from the lunar receiving laboratory, or from humans in the analytical laboratory. We have a family of six amino acids. They are glycine, alanine, serine, threonine, glutamic acid, and aspartic acid. If we have that kind of a set, we have much assurance that we're not dealing with contamination, which typically shows 17 to 19 amino acids in analysis. And this is true whether one hydrolyzes or doesn't hydrolyze. If we don't hydrolyze, we don't get any. And if we do hydrolyze, as I've indicated before, which indicates that we're dealing with precursors, we get a set of five or six. And we get this from all of the collections that have come to us from all of the missions. It's about nine collections now. This left also a question of could there possibly be contamination from rocket exhaust. Could amino acids or amino acid precursors be synthesized in the fuel that's used? And in order to, well, we had some indications against this from the laboratory because we did some simulation experiments and we couldn't find any amino acids from the kind of fuel that is used, the unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine. But we asked for and got from Apollo 15 a sample from beneath the descent engine to check on this. And not only did we, but quite a number of other groups got aliquots, portions of the same sample. We were all able to compare the amino acid content and carbon and nitrogen compounds in general from beneath the descent engine with what we got elsewhere. And when we do this, we do find a slightly higher content of amino acids from the samples that we got from the Apollo 15 descent engine. But it's within the same range of everything else that we've observed, and the general consensus seems to be, and we weren't the only ones to report this kind of result and interpretation, the general consensus seems to be that the rocket fuel is totally oxidized, and of course it's known to have that property, and it does not contribute to amino acid precursors that we find in our samples. So that we feel that the possibility of contamination is pretty well ruled out, either from human sources or chemical sources, i.e. the rocket exhaust. This is quite an important question to ask, because the proportions of amino acids that we get by this process from the various lunar samples have been very low. They run in the range of 7 to 40 parts per billion. And it has required some new developments in analysis in order to detect and identify quantitatively these amounts. And Dr. Hare of the Geophysical Laboratory, who joined us, of the other two of us, of his own accord some 5 years ago, I think deserves a lot of credit for having developed an instrument which was just in the range to be sensitive enough, it turned out, for the lunar analyses. How much time should I? I think then there arose a question of whether such very small amounts have any real meaning or consequential. And on the basis of some calculations that we've been able to make using the data from Carlton Moore at the University of Arizona, we have compared the amino acids that we get, the total amount, with the carbon that's found, the total amount of carbon that's found in the lunar samples. Now, that's much more meaningful than to talk about the amount of amino acids in the lunar samples, which are almost entirely mineral. And amino acids and amino acid precursors are organic compounds, and what's important here is their relationship to the amount of carbon. And when we do that, we find that the ratio of amino acids to the total carbon is about the same as the same ratio calculated for the meteorites, the carbon-rich meteorites like Murchison and Murray. So that if the amount of amino acid is significant in the meteorites, it's likewise significant in the lunar samples. We think that it's significant in both cases, and the fact that the ratios are so similar and even the profiles are similar is itself significant. Not just molecular evolution, it became organismic evolution, and as I guess everybody knows and worries about, we are in a stage of social evolution.
We'll take questions on this right away, I think, and then we'll go on to the next one.
You said these compounds are not properly amino acids. Well, or did I understand you to say that? And if they're not, well, what are they chemically?
Yeah. A number of investigators, now that our results have been confirmed, and they have been confirmed by two other teams, and this was true at the last Lunar Science Conference, other investigators have referred to them as amino acids. And that, I think, is loose talk. They are not amino acids. They are compounds which, upon treatment in the right way, and this is hydrolysis, H-Y-D-R-O-L-Y-S-I-S. Upon hydrolysis, they give amino acids. They do not exist as free amino acids in the lunar samples.
Well, without the hydrolysis, how do you speak of these chemically?
We speak of them as amino acid precursors. Now, that the next thing we want to do, in fact, we've already begun with this, is to identify them chemically. This is going to be even a little harder than to get to work out an analysis, a phenomenological analysis, and get other people to repeat it, because we have to teach them how to do it, of course. Is going to be even harder because it's a more complex problem to identify something chemically than to simply work out an analysis. That already took a lot of effort to do that.
Well, to put this in some kind of perspective, and I know you think about such things, but if had there been water on the moon, do you see any kind of orderly progression that would have achieved a frog or something in a given period of time?
Well, I'd rather generalize it to a living, reproducing system than to a frog specifically. Yes, I think the probability would have been high that some kind of living system would have emerged from these chemical precursors if there had been adequate water at the right time and places on the moon. The main reason I say that is from the laboratory experiments, which indicate that the subsequent processes from amino acids are ridiculously simple.
In what period of time?
Would it go from amino acids to a primitive living system? Yes. Well, this conflicts with a lot of the preconceptions. I would have to answer you and say that the experiments indicate that that would have occurred in a matter of hours.
I seem to recall that when they found some amino acids in a meteorite, that they concluded they were not from living organisms because they were not the correct isomer.
Yes.
And these derived amino acids that you have, which isomer are they? Are they the life type?
These amounts are so small that we haven't been able yet to work out a method to answer that question. And the evidence that we have that they are indigenous is of a different kind than that which has been cited for the meteorites, in which the proportion of amino acids to total sample is about 1,000 times as much.
Versus, were they put there by meteorites, or do you think that they part of the moon itself as being a planet?
Well, there are several possibilities. One of them is that they were part of the moon itself and during its own history. Another one is that they came from comets. That's, I think, not so likely. Another one, which is more likely, is that these precursors came from meteorites and that they're plastered on the surface of the moon. Perhaps the most likely one, and I think the weight on this was made this morning in this conference here, is the most likely source was probably carbon and nitrogen compounds in the solar wind. Now, there's another possible source, and that's the interstellar organic matter, because the astrophysicists have told us in the last 3 to 4 years that there are tremendous clouds of organic compounds in the galaxy. And, in fact, it's a kind of potboiler's paradise. And it could be that the solar system passed through such clouds or that such clouds passed through the solar system, and that there was an accretion on the surface of the moon and other solar system bodies of the compounds which formed the kinds of precursors that we're finding.
I have two questions. One, is there a name, a proper name for these things? And two, would you speculate a little bit on the Martian situation?
Well, with respect to the name, the economical name is amino acid precursors. Appropriate, more descriptive name is amino acids that are hydrolyzable to amino acids. What? We don't know enough about them yet. They're there in such very small proportions that we aren't able. The total amount that we get, I should put it that way, the total amount that we get and the samples that we get is just not sufficient to easily deduce what their chemical structure is. But we're going to do that. We're going to try to do that indirectly. There's growing indication that the organic material in terrestrial lava, I've collected some of this out of the flowing stream at Mauna Ulu, there's growing indication that that is a very similar kind of material. We're going to use that for a guide because we can get fairly large quantities of that. But I don't anticipate that the space program is going to give us, to start with on this, amounts that are, in our view, are sufficient to identify the chemical precursors. For that reason, we would like to have a pilot. Now, we may be wrong. There may not be that much similarity between the terrestrial lava and the lunar basalt. But if there is, why, we'll be much ahead. a second question. I really don't like to speculate about that. I think it'll be interesting to go and find out.
I didn't want to be recorded. I don't want you to say we will or will not find life. That was not the point of the question.
I can't anyhow.
Yeah. What I wanted you to talk about was you said that had there been water on the moon, that you thought that there was a very high probability that life would have started. And we know, or we think we know, that there has been water on Mars.
Yes.
And so this is sort of what I wanted you to play with. I mean,
I see.
Okay? And lava, too. We see the lava, too, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, on the basis of what we know, the prospects for Mars are certainly better than on the moon, and the likelihood, since we find this kind of amino acid precursor, something that can hydrolyze to amino acids, since we find those in two sources, meteorites and the moon, then the likelihood that that kind of material, whatever it is, will be or was present on Mars is enhanced. The water is there, to my best knowledge, though, probably in a pretty protected condition. And so I don't think we can talk about water in the same way that I was just before. It's not a great excess of solvent water, necessarily. It's more like a permafrost or something of that sort. I think it would be very interesting to ask the question on Mars. It would be a great shame not to ask it as soon as possible.
What is the amount of precursors you've got in terms of number of molecules or micrograms or so?
Well, the precursors are measured as amino acids, and that's probably very close to the proportions of the precursors. And what we have found from Apollo 11 through Apollo 16 samples is everything in a range of 5 to about 40 parts per billion. We found some that are higher, one in particular on Apollo 12, but we know that was contaminated in the laboratory. And in fact, that was useful to us because it gave us some feel for what contamination really looks like. We wouldn't deliberately contaminate something, you see, but it happened inadvertently. And then once it happened, we could see that the analysis was quite a bit different than anything we got from all the others.
Two more questions.
During the Apollo program, man has introduced water in various forms or another onto the moon in very isolated locations, of course. Would this be enough to start the evolutionary process again, or would it have to be a kind of a global phenomenon for it to occur?
Well, no, I don't think it would. I would like to emphasize one other point, and that is what we don't know. Here are 6 amino acids. We know that in living systems on Earth, there are 18 types. Now, at the beginning of evolution, here really is an unanswered question. A kind of qualification to what I said earlier. At the beginning of evolution, what we don't know is whether 6 were enough or whether there had to be all 18, such as we find in all living things today. We know the general process. We know the outlines of the general processes, both for the moon and the Earth. But maybe there is something special in the need for evolution to have as many as 18 kinds of amino acid. And if that's so, then what's on the moon isn't sufficient.
Where, in your opinion, would be the best place to look for life outside Texas?
In the solar system.
Well, I don't really make a study of comparative planetology, which is the best way to answer this question. But from what I know, I think the most likely place is Mars. And I think there are serious questions about whether or not there is life on Mars. I wouldn't want you to construe that statement to mean that I think it's likely that there's life on Mars. I don't think it can be ruled out, and I think the conditions are better there than more propitious there than elsewhere, as far as we know. The only other place in the solar system that one could even think about, I would say, is seriously, is perhaps one of the moons that we don't know enough about. And that's part of the reason for thinking about it. We don't know enough about it.
Okay, we'll move on now. Dr. Lindquist, would you like to present?
Well, basically, I had two topics. First, I just reported a preliminary result on an Apollo 17 rock. The age of this rock, determined by rubidium-strontium techniques, is 3.8 plus or minus 0.2 eons. That's 10 to the ninth years, a billion years, or however you want to say it. This is just in the way of confirmatory evidence to, as the Caltech group has already presented, ages on Apollo 17 rocks, which have greater precision than the one that I've just presented. The main topic of my presentation, however, concerned the early evolution of the moon as a whole, which we think we have some evidence for from the Apollo 16 site specifically, and also going back to all of the Apollo sites. First of all, I presented strontium isotopic data for a large anorthosite from the Apollo 16 site. Now, this anorthosite, as a matter of fact, is the largest rock returned from the moon. It has a nickname, Big Muley, and it has, as a matter of fact, it has two different parts to it. One part is the anorthositic part, and the other part is essentially a different rock type completely. My analysis showed that the strontium isotopic relationships in the anorthositic part were essentially identical to some inclusions in the Allende carbonaceous chondrite. It has been suggested by several people that these inclusions in Allende present the best candidate for primary cosmic matter, or as a building block for the moon, essentially, is what I want to say. This would seem to support that hypothesis, although it certainly is not. I should say, against using it as complete evidence for it. Then I moved on to discuss the differentiation of trace element-rich lunar magmas. We believe that this has a lot to do with the chronology of the moon, the early evolution of the moon, because obviously you have to, in order to make things happen on the moon, you have to have a heat source, and to get a heat source, you need to concentrate the radioactive elements like potassium and rubidium, potassium and uranium. So in order to completely specify the chronology of the moon, then you have to know at what time elements were concentrated in the certain lunar magmas. Working against the background of previous work done here at MSC in terms of defining lunar rock types, in particular a rock type with the acronym CREEP, which stands for potassium rare earth element phosphorus, and also for using a recently defined rock type, which we've called very high alumina basalt, one can, with reasonable geochemical assumptions, derive a time for the differentiation of these trace element-rich melts of about 4.3 billion eons ago. This is interesting in that while it's a long time ago, it's still not as long as ago as what we think the age of the solar system or the real age of the moon should be. Don't ask me to give plus or minus. As I say, this was essentially a model calculation, and it's basically an hypothesis. So I would like to waffle a little bit on that. I think it depends a lot on further work that it will be done on the geochemical relationships of these various samples. As a matter of fact, it may turn out that it's wrong. I mean, that's always a possibility we have here. So that number certainly depends on further work to be done. So at the moment, 4.3 plus or minus about 100 million years. If you want a number, I would say about plus or minus 100, at the utmost 200 million years. And thirdly, I then discussed the question of the, quote, age of lunar soils. That's one of the things that we have been puzzled about from the beginning of the Apollo program, is that the soils seem to be older than the rocks that they should have come from. I think that this can be explained as deriving from physical processes occurring at the surface of the moon, and specifically from the effect of micrometeoroid bombardment into what is called the lunar regolith. This bombardment has the effect of heating up the regolith, producing glassy particles, and probably causing volatile loss of rubidium, making the ages appear older than they really are. So I think that what we have seen, we've heard a lot about the common occurrence of ages around 4.5 to 4.6 eons. I think that the evidence at the moment is that that is not a real number, that it is caused by the provenance of this rock type with an age of 4.3 eons, and we have had a systematic bias in the soil ages. The physical processes operating at the moon's surface have caused the soil ages to be displaced from their true values. That, of course, is.
Thank you. Questions?
Was the Apollo 17 rocket you dated a basalt?
Yes, it was. It's a very similar chemically to Apollo 11 low-K basalt, if you're familiar with the terminology.
Could you elaborate a little bit on that 4.3 billion years? What happened at that point?
Well, we think that is the time when what we call when lunar magmas formed, or at least lunar for a particular rock type. I don't want to. I want to try and be as specific as possible. We're talking about only one rock type, which is called Crete, but the reason we think it's important is because it contains high concentrations of trace elements, and this what happened at 4.3, in my opinion, is that the magmas which subsequently led to the production of the rocks, and which we now find out were formed from some source material. We think, I personally follow the model of Dr. Gast, and that the magmas were formed by partial melting processes in the lunar interior. Before I go on, I ought to say that my collaborators in this work are Drs. Gast and Hubbard at MSC, and Drs. Banzo and Wiesmann at Lockheed Electronics Corporation, and Drs. Church and John of the National Research Council.
I have two or three questions. Number one, there are some scientists who think this creep stuff was probably the original, or could have been the original crust, and they prefer to think of the crustal formation or the differentiation of this creep stuff around 4.4 or 4.5. Would you say your ages was in ages were in that ballpark?
I think that's one of the things which has to be worked out yet. I personally prefer the view that the original crust was a North Acidic. This is a viewpoint that has been, I think, originally expressed by Dr. John Wood, a Smithsonian. The ages of 4.4 to 4.5 are derived from a more texturally complex rock, from a brecciated rock, which has presumably gone through a metamorphism, what Dr. Wasserberg calls a cataclysm at 3.9. And the question is, what did that cataclysm do to its age? And the data that I'm speaking of are rocks, pertain to rocks of the same general chemical characteristics, but that do not show evidence of having gone through the cataclysm. Let's put it that way. I mean, they have good textural characteristics. They're not obviously breccias.
Could you give us a sort of a, we usually do this, sort of what you think were some of the other significant papers at your session?
I think the paper by Dr. Hussein from Stony Brook, State University of New York, in which he reports age from ages of 4.2 billion years is a significant one. As you know, these are older than most ages obtained by other workers, particularly at the Caltech lab, and it's not clear yet whether the Caltech people have analyzed the same rocks, they would have gotten the same ages. But the point is that so far the Caltech people have not analyzed the same rocks. There does seem to be reasonably good agreement on when they do analyze the same rocks, at least on, and so I would think it's important to know whether or not the 4.2 billion year old ages are right. If they are, then they would fit in rather nicely with this 4.3 sort of differentiation event that I would like to have. Secondly, I think one of the important papers that was started out the session was the one by Dr. Hubbard here at JSC, in which he essentially defined some of the rocks that we've been talking about. I think in our analysis, we rely very greatly on coordinating geochemical data with isotopic data. So in that respect, his paper was essentially the basis of the groundwork for the things which I talked about.
This is really not fair, I guess, but what about the origin of creep that Wood and Taylor and Marvin talked about?
I don't really feel qualified to speak to that point. I'm basically a physicist, and you're asking me a lot of geochemical questions, and I'll just, rather than getting in too deep, I'd rather not.
I wonder if you could review again the chronological significance of the trace elements and indicate what elements they are.
Okay. Let's see. The trace elements are potassium, uranium, thorium, and what we call the rare earth elements, which are a group of elements. The reason that that potassium, uranium, and thorium are particularly significant is that they are radioactive and they would be the heat source for the early movement, and they would essentially cause the thing, any processes that were going on, any differentiation processes that were going on would have to be driven by heat sources, and these are the elements which would provide that heat. And if you can concentrate them into the moon as a whole is rather low in these elements. If you can concentrate them into a certain layer, then you've accomplished something.
And does this indicates then that the layer is among the oldest layers on the moon?
It indicates that this was one of the first things that happened. I would say I don't think it is the first thing that happened, but it does indicate that it's one of the first things that happened.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Elbaz?
What I had to say this morning was relative to the distribution and the significance of what we call the dark mantle on the moon. And the dark mantle is best identified by its low reflectivity, that is, the deposits reflect something between 6 and 8% of the incident sun rays, as opposed to, say, the brightest spots on the highlands, which reflect about 20% of the light. And the that it is, we call it a mantle because it occurs as blankets over pre-existing topography. And in many cases, you can still see the older topography through it, because in most cases that blanket is not very thick. It's only a few meters thick. These dark deposits on the moon occur in at least three different ways. Very large units that are superposed on both highland materials and on Mare units, in around smooth low-rimmed craters, which are probably volcanic craters, and also surrounding some domical structures, which are believed to be volcanic domes. It was recently realized that the most part of the lunar dark mantle is arranged, or most of it is arranged in an ellipsoidal shaped region on the near side of the moon, stretching from about 20 degrees west to 70 degrees east, and from about 22 north to 15 south. There are at least 12 regions along that ellipsoidal shaped shape, and vary in amounts between a few kilometers in width or in extension or in extent to several hundred kilometers in a few cases. Most of these deposits are believed to be volcanic, and they are the orientation of the ellipse is suggestive of something that may have to do with the lopsidedness of the center of mass of the moon. The ellipse center is about 25 degrees east, 3 degrees north, and the explanation of the shift in the center of mass of the moon by a shift in the core puts the core closer to the, or actually puts the center of mass of the moon about 2 kilometers closer to the Earth and 1 kilometer to the east. And with this, you would shift the lunar core towards the moon, towards the Earth, I'm sorry, and then a little bit to the east. So something else is really attracting, or had attracted, the center of mass of the moon. And the central point where, if you draw a line between the center of the figure through that center of that particular model of the core, it will come right about 25 degrees east, very close to the equator. So there may indeed be a correlation between the lopsidedness of the shift, or the shift, or the displacement of the center of mass of the moon, and the accumulation of volcanic units of relatively young age. These dark deposits range from Imbrian, that is around 3.8 billion years, to Upper Copernican. We do not have any absolute ages on Copernicus, but since some of them are overlain on top of Eratosthenian Mare units, for which we know that the age is around 3.1 or 3.2, these deposits range down to a lot younger than 3 billion, perhaps younger than 2.5 billion, but this is based only on photogeology. So they range at least a billion years. And in many localities, you would have several different units that may have come at different times within that large range.
Farouk, in the abstract, you referred to this as an ellipse of fire.
Oh, yes.
And I wanted you to
Okay, I call that the lunar ellipse of fire, just really to point out to the analogy of the to the Earth's circle of fire we have, where we have a lot of young, relatively young volcanism and tectonism on the Earth, and here is a region on the Moon. It's ellipsoidal in shape, and maybe the ellipsoidal arrangement is due to either the shift in the center of mass, or the fact that this part of the Moon is already depressed. The laser altimeter data shows that the this particular region is also generally lower than the rest of the Moon, or both. It may be the fact that it is that surface is depressed, and also the fact of the displacement in the center of mass have to do something with the relative or relatively recent volcanism on the Moon.
Does it appear that this area is an area that you believe where most of the younger volcanism on the Moon has occurred then?
Volcanism in general, but it ranges from the old volcanic units like 3.8 or 3.7, very close to the age of the old Mare basalts, to a lot younger. So it is, in relative terms, it's the younger volcanism. That's correct.
Let me rephrase the question. Is there much volcanism you believe that has occurred outside the ellipse?
Yes, there are spots here and there. Yes, indeed. And that you can expect on little magma pockets here and there, and this may be due to local concentrations of radioactive materials beneath the crust or whatever. But the bulk of this type of material is within that region.
I noticed that you alluded to the shift in the core in your talk as well as in this presentation. Do you have an idea of what caused the shift in the core?
No, there are several models, whether this was at the beginning, at the time when the Moon was captured in its present orbit and whatnot. There are several models, but I really do not have a specific explanation, or I do not favor one of the ideas relative to the other.
May I follow that up for just a moment? I'm not clear as to the relationship between this supposed shift in the core and the specificity of volcanism in this area. What is the relationship between these two?
Okay, actually the gravitational pull. If you had some mobile material or molten material beneath the surface, it will also accumulate where you have the most gravitational pull. And if you had that shift because of the volcanic material, will try to reach the surface in the shortest possible distance, and this is where it will get it, the distance from the magma source or the molten material to the surface.
You said that these this mantling is often quite thin. How then is it enough material to account for the offset in center of mass, center of figure? And,
yeah.
And secondly, could you comment on how these kinds of extrusions could be expected if the lithospheric thicknesses that the seismic group is coming up with are at all correct, the 1,000-kilometer kind of thickness?
Okay, first of all, I'm sorry if I gave you the impression that I'm explaining the shift in the center of mass due to that particular load of volcanism. No, I'm saying that the relationship is there, and it might only help the material to come in there. It was not the cause. It was a result of, maybe, yes. And secondly, the crustal thicknesses, or the question that relates to the crustal thicknesses, we know that the Moon is very heavily fractured, and the very large fractures that were created at the time of the colossal impacts may still be there, and they would serve as the channel ways to bring the molten material from wherever. We know that for a fact from the filling of the basins.
One more question.
What's the status now of the dark mantling material in Taurus Littoral? Is there possibility of maybe still fairly
sure,
young?
Yeah. We have no data on the dark mantle material yet. For one thing, it is apparently very fine-grained. For the other, it has not been so identified in the sample, and there is no age dates or anything, but it will come in time.
I got the impression from this morning, I guess Dr. Lucida, that she didn't think now that this is young pyroclastics. And I think she said that she was confused by the whole situation. Do you go along with that too, or
No, I really don't go along with that yet. We have to establish one way or the other, because this might be, indeed, I would say, that it can be the very fine grained regolith that was generated from these old basalts. But that we'll have to see. I cannot say.
Thank you very much. We'll have a press conference after the sessions in the afternoon.